You're listening to the Physio Matters podcast this month in association with the Active Force 2 handheld dynamometer. And this is session 88. Hi, welcome back to Physio Matters podcast. I'm still Jack Chu. And this is your monthly MSK show that you can know and trust. Thank you so much for joining us, especially last month where Tonya Vincent and Jack March got stuck into osteoarthritis in such a way that it's exposed all of you to the fact that biomechanics and biological principles and physiology back on the table in a big way, in a condition of which it felt for many of you and for me that the sort of social consequences as well as the more systemic factors around it are going to be more prevalent. Thought it was going to go the way of low back pain and be more non-specific, tissue non-specific. And yet a few question marks being raised in that direction, which was brilliant. So if you haven't listened to that, then please do. And please let us know your feedback, as many of you have been doing across social media. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, this podcast is sponsored by the Active Force 2 unit, which is a handheld dynamometer and digital goniometer that is basically a device that we think is really going to shake things up, because it's a third of the price of its nearest competitor for actually giving you a resistance reading that you can then help patients to understand what force they can generate from a particular body part. And so it's something that's technology that I think everyone's wanted in clinic, but the price has just been prohibitive. Things like the Microfet and the Lafayette units are the most common ones, but between 900 and 1200 quid to get them in hand. Whereas this at £300 exclusive price through us at physio-matters.com/AF2 changes that game completely, as well as the fact that it speaks to its own native app and gives you a force curve, as well as then you can test people's range of movement, strap it to someone's wrist, get the baseline range of movement from an inclinometer that's built into the device on, say, a frozen shoulder. I used it the other day, or the frozen shoulder. It's brilliant. And I think that that's something that we really wanted to get stuck into today on today's show with Greg Lehman, is instead of peddling this product and just touting it as being the best thing since sliced bread, let's get a critical analysis. Let's do the Physio Matters way of unpicking why it might not be if it's used badly. You know, any technology can be used for good or ill. And in this instance, we wanted to talk to Greg about where the pros and cons are measuring things and measuring power, particularly strength even, is useful. So I'm glad we got stuck into that. Now, before I do, just let me tell you a little bit about what's happened with this this device. As you might know, Physio Matters typically just do not peddle gadgets and gizmos. You know, it's something that we really feel like as a rehab-centric philosophy almost, where we really want to scale people's function. We sometimes think that it kind of gets spoilt for gimmicks and gadgets and devices and stuff. But one of the things that I think is really useful is sometimes we're assessing people and we're saying things like, oh, that feels a bit weaker on that left side. Or do you feel like you can generate less force through that? Or that feels stronger than last week or last month, or, you know, that feels like it's improving. You're guessing, and you're guessing because you have to, because there's no real sensible way in which you can objectify that. And so handheld dynamometers, where you can actually give people a readout and say, look, you're just able to generate less force on your knee extension on that side than the other side. Or look at this progress you've made from your rehabilitation, where you can now generate more force through your lateral rotation. And from loading that tendinopathy, whatever it might be. The guesswork has been inherent because you haven't really got an option. So to get a device in hand at an appropriate price that can then give you that feedback, give that the patient that feedback, is fantastic and something that we're really proud to work with Active Body on. So this is an American company who created the device that was essentially a resistance trainer, isometric resistance trainer that gave you feedback, and they basically put a dynamometer in this little egg-shaped unit. And we then worked with them to sort of develop how could that be utilized for in a more MSK compatible way, because people were using them as dynamometers, but essentially it wasn't really as fit for purpose for things like knee extension and stuff. It was a convex device, so we needed a concave attachment. So that's exactly what they did. When we've done so, the ability for us to then use that for good rather than for ill, instead of saying, look, this is a fault, a dysfunction, something that is therefore wrong based on an arbitrary sense of what is normal, obviously that's naff, but if you use it sensibly, as we come to discuss in this podcast, then we just think that's brilliant. So Greg Lehman, one of our favorite thinkers in this space, where he wants to hold everything to the same standards, we wanted to put this device, it's not in his hands, but in this concept that we're talking about and shouting about, wanted to put it under the scrutiny of someone that is otherwise seen as being sort of fair and credible and wouldn't give it an easy ride. So that's why me and my mate Greg got stuck into this measurement device and the thought about what it is to measure things in MSK generally. So I hope you enjoy it. And many thanks to Greg as ever for his time. Thanks to you lot for the feedback. And that link again, physio-matters.com/AF2. And that's for our UK listeners. We will be getting you access to it more internationally very soon. And we'll let you know. Check us out on social media if you need to find out when that might be available. Add this on to the end. Final thing from me, Therapy Live 2021 is happening. So you've heard the rumors. They are true. We are getting it done. And it's going to be bigger and better than ever. Friday, the 11th of June, is when we're doing the Therapy Live 2021. And registration opens now. If you're listening to this immediately on the Sunday, tomorrow. But generally, if you're getting tuning into this on the bank holiday, registration is now open. Head to therapy-live.co.uk to get your tickets early. As you know, we've sold out two of our last shows, and so please do get stuck into this one. 10 streams of education, and we will be announcing very soon what those themes and streams will be, but it's going to be the best MSK content you will ever know. And think what we can do. Think what we managed to do last year with 10 weeks run. Think what we've been able to do, knowing we've had a year. So I'm delighted to be here with my friend and colleague, Greg Lehman, who's now the third, probably the first, must be the first three-time guest on Physio Matters podcast under very various different circumstances. First of which, inebriated in Brighton, from what I recall. Second, I think we did argue over the internet. And this time, I've invited him on a moment's notice to talk a little bit about measurement and dynamometry. And that is coinciding with Active Force, developing the Active Force 2, which is something that we've been promoting, and we've been talking a bit about how utilizing force measurements in clinic and MSK contexts. And one of the things we were concerned about is that if we started to do any sort of podcast on it, if we were just going to have a little nodding contest about how useful these things are and things like that, then that's not really in the style of what we'd like to do, which is to think about its application, some of the challenges, some of the potential downsides of actually doing something like that. And so Greg is in the frame to sort of help us try and problematize it, as well as think about what is the utility, if any, that is sensible and applicable, that wouldn't succumb to some of the mistakes we've been critical of with other things, other gadgets, other gizmos. Is this a fad? Is this a phase? Or is this something that could actually move us in the right direction? So, Greg, for those who have been under a rock and not aware and have committed the crime of not listening to your previous podcast with us, could you just quickly introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you?
Well, it sounds like you introduced me well. You said I'm a problematizer. So I'm going to, which is actually, that is what
you
I do.
You're our little problem, mate.
I'm a physio here in Toronto, Canada. I was a chiro, so I was trained in both, but I let my license slide. I guess I'm a clinical educator and a very mediocre researcher. I did more research a decade ago, and now I just like, my joke, well, it's not really a joke, I get to jump in as the fifth author of a paper, which is, which just means you get to read it first. Actually, you know what's happening a lot now with some of my with the papers is like, I've been giving a lecture, say, on spine flexion for years, and then someone's either read my stuff or a blog, and then they turn it in, they make it a lot better, they polish the turd. And then I get a second authorship out of that. Brilliant.
So you sort of spell check it and get your name on the list.
Yeah, pretty much. That's the fifth. Hey guys, maybe we should do this. Can someone do that? So I don't even do the thing that we suggest.
No.
My favorite paper is one with Torvald Paulsen and like 10 nine awesome researchers and me. And I was the fifth, and I'm like, yeah, I'm the centerpiece of that of 10. Like I'm holding everybody up.
Well, you're the man who wears many hats on this stuff, but generally speaking, you just like to think in the direction of what is, progressive best practice without making the same mistakes of old. Like you are someone that tries to appropriately, objectively analyze each thing and not succumb to the things that others critique, and you try to maybe, is it fair to say, put everything through a similar filter? You know, you try not to make favorites of modalities or styles of practice. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes, I certainly do. Like, I try to be just as critical as my own biases of how I practice, mm-hmm. as to things that I don't buy. And I don't think that we do that well enough. And I've gotten better at that through the years. And so I probably was more rigid 15 years ago, even though I would agree with the same things. And now I see people saying the stuff I was saying 15 years ago, and I kind of like revolt at it. And I think that's too strong. You know, you mm-hmm. got to back off a little. Like, I was, you know, the best example, people might hate this, but, you know, we all prescribe, I love prescribing exercise or movement and all that stuff. But if we're just as critical of exercise as we are of, I don't know, acupuncture or ultrasound even, you know, you could really make a strong case against it sometimes, which I hate, but I think we're a little unfair sometimes.
It falls irritatingly short of sometimes the same analysis that we might put other things through. I think what I find interesting, and why, you know, you're in the frame as my go-to guy on this stuff, is because there is a version of contemporary practice that I summarize as being, if you had to put badges to it, although I don't like to, it's sort of a neuroscience education of a sort, or pain education.
Yeah.
It's a cognitive functional therapy, so PNE, CFT, and then an SNC, right? So you've got this combination of things that I, by the way, will not for a second suggest that I'm not into that, right? A version of that, although not rigid, is my practice.
I'm totally into that, me too.
However, when we recognize its component parts in each of those things, especially when tried to be tested against, then sometimes they might find themselves wanting when it comes to research, but also the mechanism of effect is still an open mystery to us all. And we're kind of understanding that this complexity is still being teased out. Now, one of the things that therefore I wanted to get you in on is that we are, for the first time in our history, Physio Matters, against its own grain, is peddling a product. It's inferring that essentially the people that have been most critical of gadgets and gizmos, and I'll hold one up on screen like I'm on a shopping channel, but essentially we are suggesting that this getting into the hands of more people, we think, would be a movement in the right direction. Now, that is not inherent, right? That doesn't come without some caveats. And so one of the things that you've been vocal of is that measuring things isn't inherently a positive thing. And that includes when it comes to sort of strength training and understanding someone's ability to generate force. Is that, again, am I characterizing that opinion of yours fairly well? And could you just unpack as to what your concerns are with regards to that?
I mean, the concerns are pretty academic. I don't think anyone's going to be harmed by measuring force and using a strength gauge. Like, I built a strength gauge over 20 years ago in our master's. Like, I have strength gauges. I have a dynamometer, you know, but I also have a full, you know, weight rack and Olympic bar and, you know, 255 pounds of weight. So I buy into that stuff. My issue is when people say you have to have these things, right? If you're not assessing, you're guessing, right? If you're not measuring these things, people aren't getting better. Anytime you denigrate someone else, that's a bit of an issue if they're not doing it. So the question with strain gauges is, to me, the question would be, when do you have to use it? When is it really, like, not using it would be a disservice to your patients? Because I think it could be helpful in lots of cases, but maybe only in 20% of those cases do you actually have to do it. Does that make sense? Like, there's a subtlety in there. Like, I would support you guys selling it. And I actually might even buy it. It looks pretty impressive because it's a lot. I have an old, you know, the Chatillion dynamometer. It's like a loaf of bread and all, like a half a stale loaf of bread. You know, it's
well, I'll give you. We'll see how this conversation goes. No, I'll pitch you it.
I buy it. I never take that stuff. Yeah.
But I'm interested though, because that makes sense. I definitely want to get into that detail. But I'm interested in whether or not you conceive of there being, and I think I understood your position as being that actually there are people of which it could be deleterious. You know, the act of of measuring that. So could we try and go there first, really, as to whether or not you feel that there are cases like that?
This is where, so it depends how you prescribe exercise. So if you're someone who thinks that you need to address an impairment, and usually an impairment in strength is compared to the other side, right? Because we don't really have good normative data, so you can't compare it. Or you could make it relative to percent body weight or something, but it's always compared to that person. So that where it could be evil is when you get into the dysfunction junction area of prescribing exercise and messing people up and be like, look, you have a 9% deficit with your hip abduction on your left side. And I know your pain is all on your right and it's a headache, but because of the lateral sling, that's why you have ear pain, because your left, you know, upper glutes aren't firing to abduct your hip. Do you know what I mean? It's a problem with like philosophy. You know, you could do that any other way, but you would get objective numbers there. That's the issue.
Torturing logic, whereby you're sort of really trying to create tenuous links, be that biomechanical or otherwise.
And you could do it with ankle sprains. So you could do it with anything. You could say, you know, you could, someone could have an ankle sprain. You could say, oh, look, you have a 11% deficit in your hip abductors on the side of your ankle sprain. And they may or may not, because it depends on the measurement error of the tool. And then you would be keeping someone in rehab when they don't really need it anymore or something like that. That's the issue. But with the other issue, not really that it's a negative, it's like, I don't often need a strength, like a strain gauge, because it's not going to change what I do. I'm still prescribing strength and conditioning exercises for certain conditions. It's not going to matter if they're weaker or not. I would still keep progressing them. It wouldn't cause me to stop. That's like more of a prank. It's not a critique of the equipment. It's whether or not you need it or not.
No, I get that. I suppose one I want to come back to on that is,
that's another one.
Independent of you, it would be, is that something that might change their behavior? And so I want to talk a little bit about its potential utility on compliance. But before we do, I wonder if, so the argument would be, and it's one that I'd agree with, that an inference of deficit as being dysfunction, asymmetry in this instance, would be a really difficult claim to defend, especially like you just described at, say, 9%. But it's also something that is making a mistake we've been critical of elsewhere by suggesting that a biomechanical asymmetry in range of movement would be something that would then, you know, make you wonky, twist your pelvis, etc. And so the suggestion that this is all within the scope of normal, you don't know what that is normal for them, the human movement is something that has a significant range. If we were to use tools that might suit our biases to say that, you know, that's weaker that side, therefore why not normalize that?
Yeah.
That is inferring dysfunction that you can't claim is relevant or causal to their pain. Is that what we were saying there?
That would be the biggest knock. And again, that's what you see with the 3D kinematic tools for measuring running assessment, right? Like there's that stuff is out there a lot. Say, oh, look, you have more pronation on this side. You know, sure. So this is a measurement problem, again, not just related to force. You know,
do you think it helps at all? Imagine if someone had, and we could apply it to 3D gait analysis as well, is that, do you think that when someone has an asymptomatic baseline on assessment, so imagine that we had, and we needn't go there with the gait, let's stick to the strength, but we understood their baseline, right, as being for some reason that they've been in and they've had some readings done, and then 12 months later, that same person, and we're not talking about an adolescent, we're talking about someone who's in their mid-20s that was unlikely to have had any major incident in which would have otherwise disrupted it. And we're therefore deducing that when you test them that second time, that the deficit is relative to their own deficit. So they didn't have an over asymmetry in their isometric quads, knee extension, sorry. And then 12 months later, they present with patellotendinopathy in a basketball player, and therefore there's a deficit. Now, it's still a bold claim to infer cause, but that's something that at least turns my eye in that direction and starts to think that may well be a relevant variable if there's a measurement, especially if you have that baseline. Do you think that's still bold of me to suggest?
No, but you just need good research to do that, to see if that deficit compared to the other side, so the asymmetry is a true risk factor. But yeah, that's possible. I got nothing more. But you need research to tease that out.
Yeah, you would on a macro level. But I mean, on a patient presenting, I just wondered if you would, because if I adjust my case study on the thought experiment and say someone typically is not presenting with that known deficit relative to their own data 12 months ago. So most of the time you're meeting someone afresh.
Data 12 months ago, was there an asymmetry? So their left side was weaker compared to
there wasn't.
Oh, okay, there wasn't. And then they present 12 months later and they have it. You have an idea. That you don't know if it's the weakness that caused the patellar tendinopathy or the patellar tendinopathy.
What I'm arguing is that would it then potentially hint at a reasonable case to try to, that's something worth working on, and then we can see. We won't know whether it solves it, but I'm saying that measurement, in that instance, I'm saying that I'd be glad I tested it, is what I'm saying.
So I wouldn't. I guess this is why you wanted me on, because I'm going to give strength and conditioning exercises for that person regardless of what I found with the strength testing. But, and I know you want to go over, and this is where it probably would be nice for patient adherence, right?
Right.
You show someone, look, you're like 30% weaker here. It could be worthwhile doing these things. We have pragmatic evidence that doing these exercises is helpful. Although if you look at it, the changes in strength don't seem to correlate with improvements in function and pain and all that stuff and return to sports.
That's definitely somewhere that we need to go, is that if you to over infer, again, the mechanism of reason for recovery. We know this a lot from the tendon work, and I know.
Yeah.
I won't. If I was to give my opinion on that, I would be literally channeling things that you've taught me. So it would be properly false. You know, things I've learned on your course that are still talking points of mine, because I don't have any authentic and novel points to make. But on this, it's kind of the compliance piece makes a massive difference for me. And one of the reasons why I'm kind of getting into it and finding myself using it more in my practice is because the ability to then make a case, which you often are doing, right? I'm pitching someone this idea that you're presenting, and this is sort of feeling like it's a patellar, what did I use as an example? Patellar tendinopathy, that you've developed. And this is what I would propose as being the management. You're absolutely right. The indication of me having measured them doesn't necessarily change its management. However, my ability to then say, I want us to aspire to create at least more symmetry, or just more capacity, or more strength, or you being able to generate more force against this. And their ability, especially because of the time frames involved in something like that often, the ability for me to then benchmark that against something and measure them against their own force is something that I find, I look forward to us potentially, and we're going to contribute where we can to collecting that data to understand just how much it does improve compliance. But as a general rule, I find that to be something that is quite useful, much like someone is weighing themselves at home. It's something that when they're aspiring to something, and that benchmarking is somewhat sometimes useful. Do you think there are occasions, though, of which that could go awry, where people would maybe obsess? You know, I could give concern to the fact that if you pick the wrong person, they could obsess over that and then be, you know, if we couldn't normalize that deficit, is that something that they would then attribute to their own pains and issues and injuries?
Yeah, that would be the concern, because they can recover and not have large changes in their strength, and they feel like they can't return to sport. And we don't have that certainly for patellar tendinopathy. It might be pretty valuable for ACL, because we do know that having a greater than 90%, like having more symmetry with the ACL, like with quad strength with the ACL, seems to be, it won't guarantee that you don't get re-injured, but it's the base threshold that you need. If you're under it, then you are more likely to get injured. Right. So there's some good evidence for that. And that's all I mean when it comes to strength. Like, I think it's important to test sometimes, and that's the debate.
Okay.
Right. So what you guys might want to do is, like, these are all that, like, if you're thinking at this of this, like, research wise, like, where there is where this might be useful, and then that's what you want to test, right? That's why is it helpful. And then people like me will say, well, I could, like, when it comes to a strength deficit, I believe you can just, if you're just doing leg extensions, you could just, what's your 5 rep max? You know, you can do stuff like that. You, as long as you get into the ballpark. And yeah, people say, oh, it doesn't correlate that. It correlates differently with, say, an isokinetic dynamometer and all that stuff. Well, so what? Like, it will still track improvements if your 5 rep max goes up. But not everyone wants to do that. So using a dynamometer is helpful as well. It's just another way to do it.
But it's not, yeah, your issue is when people infer that it's essential each time, right?
And that's where I have
almost like a mandatory thing.
That's that's it. It's just a super quibble, and I realize that. there's other ways to do it.
Sure. Right? Sure.
Especially if we want physio in parts of the world where, like, you know, there's limitations in their infrastructure.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I still think you can be a good
physio. You're setting a bar to entry that's arbitrary and unnecessary.
But if you can afford it, it does look cool. There is something like for, you know what I mean? Like, let's be honest here. There's probably something about having that gadgetry, right? That for buy-in and for like to justify your fees and all these things. Not everyone just wants your advice. They want these other special things. So I get it.
Greg, I'm sat in front of this fancy microphone that's not even plugged in. So I totally agree. Having all the gear and no idea and having a good show is exactly what we're about. I think what I'm interested in is whether you think that independent of symptoms, whether or not any of the benchmarking work has occurred where on return to play, do you think that either we have the data now you mentioned ACL where obviously there's more data than other injuries, but do you think that even in the future it is likely that there will be thresholds of which we can give people suggestion as to that being safe or less safe for them to return to play based on strength metric measurements?
I think if the research gets done, which is unlikely because there's so many other things that need to be funded.
Yeah, sure.
It'll never be like really hard and fast, but it'll slightly increase your probability of not getting re-injured. You know, yeah. It's one thing that's
you
in,
reckon
the, in the
it, you reckon it would.
For certain things, we'll get an idea. Like, I think you want to know, yeah.
Yeah, because I'm a bit on the fence on that, to be honest. Like,
depends on the case.
Sure, but that's why. Does it depend on the case? Does it depend on the case in such a granular way that you end up in a situation where no matter how you try and create those inclusion criteria on a trial, that it would be, you just have a watered down effect.
Oh, sorry. I meant depends on the conditions, not the, certainly it'll depend on the person, but you'll never know that. at a person specific level, I don't think you'll know when strength is needed. We make guesses. And I think it's still good to think that way as a clinician. Like I have a rough schematic when I think strength is needed. Condition wise, that will help you make generalizations when you need to do that.
Okay. I want to speak to the biomechanist that I know and love, and think that when someone is, say, running, and we know that their running form might alter the forces of which then are distributed through their lower limb based on, say, vertical displacement or their particular foot strike, whatever it might be. Yeah. Do you think that then when measuring strength in whatever capacity, style or whatever you've decided to do to measure things, do you think that observing someone or knowing of that their particular form and then thinking you're more likely to need more quad strength than your counterpart who doesn't run like that, do you think that that's a too fine a detail that's highly unlikely to be relevant?
It is. It doesn't seem, and this is where it's really difficult when you got to know the full body of literature. The only thing where it's a bit of debate where strength seems to correlate with form in some studies and not in others would be like hip abductor strength and pelvic drop. Sometimes there's a loose correlation, but it's not that strong. And other studies show that it is. But if you remember that the study I talk about with hip abductor drop and pelvic drop and hip abductor strength, where they inject the paralyzing agent, that's the Pohl study and Kendall as well, where if you don't paralyze but decrease the strength of the hip abductors, there's no change in pelvic drop during walking. So low load activity, it doesn't matter. I think strength becomes more important in higher loads. So running may be pelvic drop, but not consistently. That's the thing. So in general, I think how someone runs isn't influenced by how strong they are. So that would be too granular. That's you can't say anything there.
You'd be over deducing. I think that the because if that was the case, or there was even a subtle difference there in what your capacity needs were based on your individual form or the fingerprint that is, say, your form, then that's the sort of thing that makes it very difficult to tease out on a research trial as to the relevance of strength in any given time, because you've got, you really are in that N of one category because there's too many independent variables.
Yeah, with studies like that, they try to find correlations, but then we can also look at the prospect of stuff, which doesn't mean to, but like where they'll increase someone's hip abductor strength, measure kinematics, and you don't see any changes.
Right.
That's the other way to look at it. So like someone's strength is increasing, you're not going to see running technique change. But what people will say there is like, now if you increase the strength, so maybe their technique won't change automatically, but now you've given them the option to change. Now they have to do motor learning principles or something and retrain their gait or something like that. So someone else, so if you didn't have that strength, you might not be, the motor learning wouldn't take. That's the theory. And so that is testable, but difficult.
It's tricky. And as you say, unfortunately, me and you are going to be like nihilists on this and saying, because of the likelihood, the unlikelihood of anything of this being funded, then it ends up being a bit academic, doesn't it?
No, because that's the thing, because what are you going to do in practice? And that's how I practice, right? It doesn't really matter to me. I'm still going to give strength exercise because I know pragmatically they can be helpful. And I still might do gait retraining because I know it can shift the stress on the tissue. So would I use, going back to your thing, your dynamometer, do I need that? No. But could it be helpful? Yes.
Sure.
Does that seem fair? Like, that's kind of my take. I'm still an optimist here. I'm not that much of a dick.
I get you. But I don't want to slide off, because I think, you know, there's something to be said about your critique of the necessity that I think is really interesting. So would you say, when you do... Because I think one of the things you've pushed back on, and I understand why, is this notion that, yeah, if you're just guessing, if you're not measuring, it's not accurate enough, then I get why you're frustrated by that. Admittedly, though, one of the sort of sales strap lines that we're considering at the moment and marketing this thing is stop guessing. Because one of the things that we're saying is to people that if out of your mouth comes the following styles of terms, right, where that feels weaker than your right arm feels weaker than your left arm, or that feels stronger than last week, or, you know, and this does range as well. So it's kind of like, oh, that you look like you've got more elevation this week. If you're saying that and inferring that, then to me, you know, at least having something to back that claim up is better than not. Now, if you're not saying that or inferring those things are relevant variables, it is a slightly different thing. But I would argue that most people can't help himself, myself included, in sort of saying stuff like that and feeling a bit of a imposter, because we are kind of guessing and we are sort of giving our best guess, but we kind of can't objectify that, in part because of the price point challenge that comes from these things that could measure it. So in those contexts, do you think, is that progress?
Oh yeah. That if you're, it's funny, I'm trying to write a blog for like 3 years on like exercise prescription algorithm. It's tough because it depends how you choose exercises, because I don't choose them up to correct deficits. That's not, I'm not looking for deficits and I'm not hunting them and then correcting them. But I know that is a practice style that people do. Like, I just took a course with Simon Lack and Brad Neal, you know, and they're like, oh, look, your hip is weak. That's why we need to do hip abductor exercises. So I was like, oh, whatever. I would have done them anyway. Like, I don't need someone to be weak, but if your practice style is, I'm going to find a weakness and I'm going to choose exercises to correct it, then you should be using your tool. Like, I would agree with that, or some measure of strength. Right.
But I suppose that, you know, what you've just described in terms of a dysfunction and correction model, or aspiring to what would be,
or impairment correction. Yeah.
Impairment. Right. Independent of that, because I struggle to admittedly think that way, influenced by you, of course, and others, but I would say that if you're seeing someone that you're not trying to correct for a dysfunction or an impairment necessarily, as much as they are in a position whereby be coincidence or otherwise, they're presenting with what is, you know, your reasoning, your assessment, as you've deduced that they've got, say, subacromial pain, they've got tendinopathy, cumbersitis that's irritable, and that they're, you know, when you load up their posterior cuff or load up their shoulder into external rotation, they can't generate as much force on that side, it's painful, and they want to be able to do that for whatever reason, particularly there's some functional reason as to they want that movement, and they want to be able to generate more force in that, or being able to lift more comfortably. That's the sort of thing where it's not necessarily correcting for an impairment that we're suggesting is the problem, but we're just saying that you want to be able to generate more force there. Therefore, I wonder what your baseline is. When we see you in a couple of weeks' time, can you generate more force through that? It's not a correction, which, of course, you know, I disagree with that model of practice, but I think I'm finding these things to be compatible with my, you know, aspiring them to be able to generate more force into lateral rotation by saying this was your baseline. It's not necessarily corrective as such, but I just think that doing that compared to what might have otherwise come out of my mouth, which was, it feels like you're compressing into my hand harder this week. I felt like an imposter saying stuff like that, because you feel like you're leading the witness. Of course I would say that. I'm trying to infer that you're better. Whereas trying to be authentic, it feels better for me to say, look at this number, there's more zeros in behind your numbers this week.
Yeah, it's better feedback. No, again, no problem with that stuff. It does go back to, like, if you want to lose weight and you're going on the scale, it's the same idea.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what frequency do you think it might become more likely to be an issue? Like, if I imagine on that same logic, if you got someone to do it twice a day and were obsessing over measurement, do you think that would be likely to decrease self-efficacy rather than improve the compliance like we're talking about?
Probably, but I think you should test a lot just to show that there's going to be natural variability and get people comfortable with the test, because you don't want to have a false increase in strength because they're just better at doing the test.
But then you've got the problem with them. If you test regularly to demonstrate variability, you're also improving their practice with said test.
That'll wash out after a while. And then you'll start getting true strength gains, right? And then initially you're going to see you'll see natural fluctuations that might be in the measurement, but actually might be in their ability to produce force. And that's good too, because then you can show, like, you got the potential. You're going to have good days and bad days here. It's just hard to say, is it natural variability or is it like fluctuations in pain and performance?
So you're going to get you might get an artificially low initial reading then.
For sure, you will. And you will as a tester.
Yeah, that's true.
And you guys first buy this, get good at using this.
That's one of the things I was going to say, is we need to be doing some more. That is going to be the advice and is the advice and instructional videos we're going to produce. But what would you say, though, is someone presents, as I just described it, with a sore shoulder, and you're then doing some on your initial consult, you decide to use this as a means of getting some documented numbers into their note, and you're careful to not infer that that's sort of a fault or dysfunction that needs to be corrected, that's a prerequisite for their recovery. Got you. But how many 6-second contractions are we wanting them to do in order for us to be considering that's valid? Because it bloody hurts.
I'm not sure. I just know that because I did some of this with my master's, and I was just doing this lately when I was measuring spine kinematics. You want to do a lot. I don't know what the numbers are. It's more than three. But you do the start of the session, the middle of the session, the end of the session, but you're going to fatigue, of course, but then repeat it the next time they come in. Just so you want to get a really good baseline.
Yeah, well, that's what I hoped you wouldn't say, because it's like that's where it feels like suddenly you've got a device that you're wanting to use credibly, but then similarly it becomes less practical because of the, you know, if we just did, we've got three different movements, sort of three different planes of which we want to test this, but we're going to do 8 for every single one over the course of the next hour or something. It just feels like
You could get away, have the person warm up, do like, don't trust the first day, it would be the next day. Do like 3 and then another set of 3. And then the next time they come in later that week, repeat that again. I bet that would be a pretty good baseline somewhere in there, that second day of testing.
Yeah.
Probably be better. That's typically what research does.
But then clinically, yeah, to see you. Unless your initial assessments span 3 days.
You know what? They kind of do, because like I never get anything done on the first one. So I'm like, so kind of. Yeah, like, my notes suck.
Because you're finding so many dysfunctions. That's why.
That's right.
You're just assessing them. They've got to go through your full screen, I imagine, right? Top to toe. Oh,
so much work. Everyone needs so much work. I don't know how you walked in here.
So broken. Exactly. We need to make sure we move people towards that video in which you deconstruct Mimi's dysfunctions on that.
Oh, the Layman Initiative.
Dr. Yeah, Greg from the Layman Initiative. You know, I was listening back. That was the last time you were on Physio Matters, just after that. And so we did introduce you as Dr. Greg of the Layman Initiative. So maybe we'd do one of those. When you get a device in hand, this will help you to break down her dysfunctions even further.
I did just get a call from the principal the other day about her. She got into a fight with some boy.
Really?
She was defending her space or something. Anyways, enough of that. But you know, I would the idea of impairments, I'm not willing to say they're out completely irrelevant. So if you practice that model, that's okay. It's just hard to know when they are irrelevant. I think we still have relevant impairments sometimes, and this will help. And so, but again, depending on your practice style. Like this is why I use such general terms, and it's really a cop out. Where I'll say, "Well, we're just like making the system as good as it can be," you know. That's the practice style of like, okay, what do you suck at doing? Okay, well, let's work on that. But that's still the impairment model. You find something that's
It's low hanging fruit. That's why people have. That's why our mate Brad has an issue with the overuse of the term capacity. Is that he's right? It's nebulous. It's vague. It's purposefully like
on purpose. You know,
We're in a situation where we're all sort of trying to talk broadly about thresholds because we're being imprecise because we can't bring the precision without them feeling like we're just bullshitting, which is one of the tough things. I think where with the impairment, another it's completely subjective, which I don't like about it, but I'm looking for massive overt. I overuse the word overt, but it's like just this when someone is doing something that is particularly a strange way of which they're moving it. And by strange, again, I'm being vague, but it's kind of like when someone is, say, throwing, then I'm not able to understand the sort of chicken and egg as to whether they're throwing like that because it hurts or is it hurt because they're throwing like that. But generally speaking, when someone's doing something that is sort of wildly different, then those things are sometimes dysfunctions that can bring your attention to something quite important, you know, a nerve palsy, you know, that brings your attention to an overt level of atrophy of which there's then some sort of pathology. I've been alerted to two tumors due to sort of a really quite odd biomechanics. And so that's where, you know, I do agree with you that we've got to try and hold out some room for analysis of what dysfunction, but it's not on a granular level whereby we're nitpicking something that isn't obvious to the naked eye or something that needs to be then pathologized when there aren't those major factors that I've just described. Because you talk about this stuff quite a lot, do you find people misunderstanding you on that and that people think that you're inferring that anyone can move however which way they like?
Oh yeah, of course. That's why the free lecture I always do now is when biomechanics matters, just to try to clarify that.
Yeah,
because it certainly does. Just figure out when
the Harley and those categories, as a spoiler alert, being the sort of higher, typically the higher the, I don't know, what would you say, the higher the impact, or higher the force, or higher the capacity, or higher the challenge, or at the top of at the limits of tissue threshold. You're sort of talking about when.
You have fewer options.
The limits of function, you've got to decrease your movement variability typically. Because you're trying to match your, you know, I'm completely butchering it here, Greg. So just take.
Yeah, no, that's it. Or like and that's when strength matters too. Like, you know, it's like the Nord board with the hamstring researchers. The strength of the hamstrings, the ability to produce force, and the length of the fascicles does seem to matter when it comes to hamstring sort of injury, like secondary prevention and primary prevention. So that's a really good example of when, so high loads, high forces, it matters. The ACL will tear in certain positions, you know, if it's knee abduction, hip adduction with a relatively straight knee and you load it up, it'll tear. What's interesting though is it won't tear if it's abducted and adducted and the knee's flexed, right?
Yeah.
Like that's why you skateboard, but you know, where you're like speed skateboarding. What's your sport called?
Mountain boarding.
Okay. But if you every skateboarder who does a massive jump, what position is their knee in when they land? It's valgus, but it's flexed, right? That's the classic style. People freak out about that. So biomechanics matters, just not often how people think. That's like the debate. But yeah. Going back to the strength thing, and this is where you said it, I think you alluded to the pornography test, where that means like we can agree on what's pornographic if like you know when you see it, but it's hard to define. That's that Supreme Court justice ruling of obscenity. So it just has to be, oh wow, yeah, that's obscene. But when it comes to little debates, that's where it's hard. But with the strength testing, that's what we don't know is what if 10% is relevant, a 10% difference under high loads. That's where the having just not doing manual muscle testing certainly isn't enough, but that's where having a strain gauge might be important for high loads and return to sport like that.
And that's where I think that condition-based and cohort-based study is going to be really interesting, because I can think that there would be, in the general population, I think that's going to be difficult to really tease out the relevance of. You know, if you did a prospective study on this or of otherwise uninjured people where you got some baseline data and you tried to work out as to what the relevant deficits would be in terms of their predisposition to injury, I just can't comprehend necessarily that being that relevant. Whereas in a sporty population of which or not always fair to consider them to be completely well-rounded athletes, but to some degree, your triathletes, at least the multi-sport triathletes, they're fairly well-balanced in a sense that they might then, of a cohort of triathletes, you're recognizing that their bigger fish to fry aren't necessarily taken up. You know, you're in a situation where they've got a decent baseline of fitness and capacity. They are in a situation where they are not, unlike the general population, they're less sedentary, and they're less likely, I'd imagine, to have overt range of movement deficits or whatever it might be in that subset. And then you take it further and say amongst those with patellofemoral pain. So I suppose that's where done well, I can imagine that those deficits might be relevant. But I guess until we know, you would want to not take that next step as to suggest that something is relevant. Until we come to know that, if I get a triathlete that presents with patellofemoral pain and I notice that he's then 10% down on his quads extension using, you know, an appropriately validated measure, you'd feel particularly uncomfortable for me to infer that that's relevant. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not to say that I wouldn't advocate strength training. I would just, do you know what I mean? That's the,
I do. I get you. There wouldn't be a difference between necessarily how we'd manage that, partly because I parrot your methods, but I would start to, maybe I'm being a bit premature, but I would probably infer that I suspect that to be relevant. Let's say there's nothing else I've found, right? I'd be so surprised if that was coincidental. I'll admit that.
Oh, you know, do they have pain?
Yeah, they're presenting with patellofemoral pain.
Yeah, sure, they have pain. I don't care.
Well, they wouldn't be presenting to me otherwise. I did say that, I promise.
But what's so amazing, here's a study that needs a follow-up. This is the issue with strength. So a paper just came out. It was with, so, you know, I always say like train locally, train at a distance. That's a, if you look at all the research, it tends to agree. So if your knee hurts, what should you do? Something at the knee, something at the hip or the foot. And then you're like, okay, well, what do I do at the hip? And I'm like, so this is where it's tough. How do you choose the exercises?
That's your favorite at the moment.
I love that. I do. I don't believe in ban the clam. I'm like, let's all have clams. There's nothing wrong with the clam challenge. But let's say, honestly, there's a few ways to choose exercise. You could say, well, let's find where someone's weak relative to a population norm or to the other side of the body. Let's find where something just is, they struggle at it. And so honestly, I actually have prescribed clamshells to elite triathletes because they struggled at it on their painful side. They could do like 50 on their non-painful side and 15 where they have their knee is aching as they're doing a clamshell. And I'm like, you know what? You can't do this, so let's do it. It was the do what you suck at. Or you could choose an exercise where you say, well, what do they have to return to? How should I prepare the person? And then that way you don't really need to do any strength assessment. You just say, what's the sport demand? So pragmatically train the hip.
That's a useful thing to get, go on. Sorry, were you going to?
So I'm just saying you need a framework, but let me just tell you this paper quickly. So what they did is they compared hip abductor strength training versus adductor strength training. I loved it. I was so happy to see it. Because I always say part of my shtick is like, you know, you guys don't, everyone loves the glutes, but you know, there's some old research by Tim Tyer where he did hip flexor training for knee pain and people got better as well. And so I used to say, well, let's do adductor. Someone did it. And guess what? With knee pain, no difference. Both groups improve comparably. So the next question is, well, what if we tailored our strength training to the weakness that the people had? That's what you want to know. I'm telling you what you want to know, young man. I explained you.
I definitely want to try to. I suppose it's one of them whereby you can comprehend that model, and you can comprehend a few different reasons as to underneath the mechanism of effect of why that intervention might well have done it. But it's not necessarily just because I'm aspiring to find corrections. As much as it's more that would be, it seems, although there might be 10 ways to skin a cat, I would find it bizarre if it turned out there were 100 ways to skin that cat. Like that sure. To me would say, and also maybe I'm clinging, like many others do more narrowly than I do, but I'm potentially clinging to some sort of a set perception of expertise. Do you know what I mean? It's like there is, I'd love for there to be at least a range of correct answers. And if it turns out, which it may well do, that it turns out that actually, you know, if you it's just the generic act of exercising, right? And that the contralateral shoulder would have done just as well, then admittedly, I would be more demoralized and I would retire sooner because essentially we end up dispelling too many. That's one myth too far even for me. And so yeah, I do maybe cling to at least a grain of logic to this, which I worry about. I wondered if I could ask, because I think the listeners would be fascinated as I would to know, are you a lumper or a splitter when it comes to functional exercise? So if someone has come in and you mentioned before about the fact, do you strengthen, say, what's weak, or do you just think about the functional capacity of it? So if someone is particularly, it's painful when they're cutting and the knee hurts, right? Then do you therefore do a version of a graded exposure approach where you find a tolerance level that they're comfortable with and you just have them do cutting or landing style drills? Or if you've noticed, as you did say, that they're terrible at doing a clamshell, is it one, the other, or both?
Both. Because I'm actually my first mentor was Digby Sale. He's the father of specificity. Like he was the one who was always saying, like, you got it. He didn't actually, he would teach his research that you got to be very specific to get the adaptations. But he also taught there's a massive carryover, right? And so if someone had cutting issues, I'd be like, you'll also get benefit from doing deadlifts or single leg squats or even going in the machine and doing quad extensions, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's carryover. Like if you just do quad extensions in a senior group and in a group of seniors, it'll improve their timed up and go.
Yeah.
You know, I love that research. So I want to take advantage of all of that. So I would do both. Like there's the task specific, you know, the return to sport type stuff and this general, you know, strength and conditioning where you just build up the whole system.
So if I was to be a prick and try to get you to prioritize those, so for some strange reason, this particular athlete is insistent that they're only going to do one or the other. And I just wondered, especially if you're in a situation which often occurs whereby the task specific stuff, they can only really do it, say 50-60% because of symptoms or because of their sense of it, or you know that you're going to demotivate them for it being sore if they hobble out of the clinic, but they can then do knee extensions at 80-90% capacity of their own potential. And they can really load that limb up on a non-specific thing far higher. Does that sway you one way or the other in terms of where you'd prioritize that?
No. But what the person wanted to do would sway me.
Right.
Okay. So for sure, if they really just wanted to do the task specific stuff and they really enjoyed doing their sport and they were honest that I'm not going to do these stupid exercises, I'd be like, okay, let's do that. Let's do these other ones here and maybe modify them a little bit. Like, so if it's cutting, maybe do it really slow and then it turns into like a squat, you know, just as a warm up or something like
would
that.
Would that play the other way as well? Whereby if someone's just not, you know, actually it turns out that I only play tennis for mum and dad and actually I hate it, but I'm really fancy myself a beefcake. Would you then say, okay, fine, we won't do any cutting drills at all and we'll just load you up under the rack? Yeah,
for sure.
Fine. Okay. You see, that's the thing. Admittedly, I would have thought that you would have been at least trying to offer some persuasion for some functional training, that comprehensive capacity where you might feel that you're being possibly too specific.
I'm so impressed. I wrote a paper like 15 years ago on golf specific training. And I was all about, it has to be rotation. It was like a swing fan and weighted clubs and all that stuff. And cable punches, you know, and then I started looking at the literature and I kind of already knew this and I was going to have it. And the literature was just showing like boring old strength and conditioning exercises in machines was improving club head speed. There's a massive carryover with these just building up general adaptations, the general preparation. So I would still do that. Yeah. It's neat. We seem to think we have to be too specific. We don't need to be that specific sometimes.
The body organizes itself pretty well on stuff like that. The act of practicing isn't necessarily the act of training. If you develop that strength, then it does seem to transfer it. But that doesn't always carry over to form. Like I mentioned it as being almost like a fingerprint, but it's obviously not as unique as that. But it's like, because of what you've just described, why do you think it is that really we kind of, most of us do assume a version of our particular form in various different tasks and that doesn't massively alter?
Some of it's just habit and some of it is efficiency. I think that when it comes to like endurance sports, I think the most efficient technique will come out. But when it comes to producing force, like one or two times, like sprinting, not that you take two steps during sprinting, but sprinting, I don't think we're as self-organizing, because if you want to be efficient, sprinting isn't efficient. Your goal is to produce the most force like per stride into the ground, right? That sometimes that, and you only have to do it. For me, it's only 10 and a half seconds for the 100 meter, but you don't have to be efficient. Do you know what I mean? So it's different than running 5K. And same with the tennis serve. If your goal is to produce the most force.
How are you using the term efficient though?
Metabolic efficiency.
Metabolic efficiency, yeah, but it's still task specific.
And comfort.
Task efficiency for sprinting is the most efficient.
Yeah, I know, but your goal is to go fast.
Stakes are higher per step, per contraction.
Yeah, but you won't be able to always figure it out on your own. That's what I'm saying. It's like it's the same. Like sometimes,
because it's
like
so fast, right? So because it's going to be so reflexive, for want of a better term, you're thinking that couldn't be the self-organizing principle metabolically that you describe in non-endurance sports. You don't think that would occur?
I don't think it applies as much in sprinting. I think it applies more in endurance sports.
That's interesting. I go the other way. I just thought that, yeah, something like throwing max velocity, you're throwing a ball, like, so you give a non-shot put or a shot put and just say throw that as hard as you can. I don't think that it'd necessarily be super efficient, but if you gave them general parameters on what is known to be a smart technique, I think that there'd be sort of a self-organizing principle that in some ways would be more efficient than endurance.
I think they'll figure out the best way to do it like 100 times. I'm just
right.
But not once. I think there's something about max force, it's different.
Yeah.
You know, we're coaching like a strength coach, and I'm not good at this for like a deadlift or a clean or something like that. I think sometimes you do things that would be counterintuitive to produce the most force, and that's where coaches really help those heavy things.
Mm, right.
Yeah. It's the same thing like in gymnastics, like because that's what I do lots of, and you need a coach because you're not going to do the thing that's on your own. You just won't figure it out sometimes. Someone needs to say you need to do it this way, and that you would never consider that option because it's just one trick. It's not about being like the least metabolic cost.
And that's a great point. We'll wrap up there, mate. I really, really enjoyed the chat and good to catch up always, but you're also coming to Manchester this year and it's actually going to happen. We've had two rearranged dates. And so we've got a date that we're going to be Greg's going to come to Choose Health HQ in July. I'll put the date in the show notes because I can't exactly remember when it's
been. Me neither. Keep changing.
And so as long as he's allowed in the country, which, you know, I think obviously there's two things there. Is it legal for tourists to come, and is it legal for Greg Lehman to come? They're two slightly different metrics. But if that is the case and the world allows, then we're going to have Greg hosting a course at our place, and we're really excited for that. Honestly, I've said this publicly a number of times, and I'll say it again here. It is, you know, I'm not just saying it because he's in an earshot, but he is the best course I've ever been on because of the way in which it's based on principles rather than pathways and metrics, as to suggest that this is a way of thinking. It's sort of giving you some tools, but it's also making you then apply them more sensibly. So please do join us in Manchester if you haven't already got a ticket, because it's I'm quietly confident this time. Third time lucky, mate.
Me too.
What do you point people to these days? GregLehman.ca, that's the website, isn't it?
Yeah, and I have another one which I keep forgetting about. I created OA Optimism last year at the start of the lockdown. It's my free like osteoarthritis resource. Mm. And I actually like it. I always forget.
Is your movement fundamental stuff, is that on the or is that the OA Optimism stuff?
That's OA Optimism. It's just the simple like 3 to 7 minute videos on pain and knee OA and activity, and then boring old action. There's a whole clamshell section. I'm not kidding. There is a clamshell.
Have you had your mind blown by the last Physio Matters podcast with Tonya Vincent yet?
No,
she brings sheer forces back to the table, mate. So you're gonna have to have a listen to Tonya Vincent.
Remember? Was that the knee OA one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I bookmarked it.
Yeah, you'll enjoy that.
About unloading it.
Like it did me. Let me tell you. Yeah, about distraction and loading, and as well as the fact that paralyzed limbs don't get away and stuff like that. Because
I have no problem with that. Remember when we start the courses, when do you have to back off? And like there are cases where we got to back off. When does the exposure-based model, like when does it fall short? And always a good one.
But then by her logic, what's fascinating is you can think that if someone has a biomechanical and or genetic disposition, that they create more, say, shear forces due to torsion. So are they someone that probably shouldn't be, even on a graded exposure model, playing tennis or football? That might be back on the table. Like that's something that used to be a myth that we would bust based on the fact that, why couldn't you train your tolerance? But actually, by listening, I think that the sort of genomics as well as the findings that they found rheumatologically on biopsy of the cartilage and what it can do and things like that just seems to bring a few more things back to the table, which is fascinating. So I'd love your reflections on that one day.
Yeah, I'll have to look into it. I mean, I don't really like those conclusions, but I'm open to some of it. Perhaps at an extreme small percentage of people, there might be something there. Same thing with knee valgus or varus. Yeah. We've known some of that with varus positioning. Going to like extreme varus, there is a greater predisposition to clinical OA, mm-hmm. both like in its progression and its incidence. So there's something
Here's a fun tenuous link. And if there are those variables, then we're better off measuring it, aren't we, at some point? There we are. Finally, I've managed to bring it all the way back around. Thanks as ever for your time, mate. Really appreciate it. And good luck with all you're doing. Hopefully see you in the country in a few months' time for a beer.
All right. Thanks, Jack. Two beers.
Bye. And that was session 88. Many thanks to Greg for his third appearance on Physio Matters. I'm sure that he's the first to be on three. So yeah, massively appreciate his time. But it just felt like an appropriate person to put our thoughts regarding measurement through the scrutiny of someone, rather than thinking, right, who can we get that would peddle the glorious benefits of dynamometry just as we happen to be selling one? That wouldn't be really our way. And also, it's not what we're thinking. You know, we're not sort of thinking about how can we do this. I mean, one of the things we can do, we want to try and make Physio Matters free, keep those therapy live, free at the point of access. Can we then work with sponsors and partners who we really like their products, their services, their values, that we think that getting their products and services to proliferate within MSK will help us with our wider project of raising MSK standards? And that's what we're trying to do as a funding model, to try and make these things happen. You imagine the bandwidth it costs us to try and get therapy live done at such a scale. And the fact that we get people that, that otherwise wouldn't be able to access this material because they couldn't afford, able to because it's free. And then we then work on a certain percentage of you guys recognizing that getting something like this in hand in your clinic, in your service, in your department for just 300 quid. That's the sort of thing that if we can work with them to do that, then that's how we can keep our stuff ticking over as we do. So really appreciate you supporting them. physio-matters.com/AF2 for more information and to buy it while stocks last, as I mentioned before. Huge thanks as ever to all of our guests for Therapy Live Pelvic Health, which happened last month. Can't believe how well that went. If you haven't already, check out the therapy-live.co.uk, register for your ticket for the big show, but also you can access all the recordings on via membership at £10 a month. And so excited for all the new iterations of what we've got in store for you this year, especially knowing what we've got to come for the program, which we'll be announcing speakers on a weekly basis and announcing contents and topic, as well as you being able, as especially if you're Physio Matters members, you can access and contribute to the idea and pool of information as to what topics you want, what you want us to be doing, what speakers you want to see for us to give platforms on Therapy Live and on Physio Matters. So thanks as ever, appreciate you, and we'll speak to you soon. Now, something I did forget to do is get Greg to do the cheesy sign out, so I will do it. You've been listening to the Physio Matters podcast, discussing Physio Matters, because physio matters. Bye for now.